Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled A Conversation with Walter Wriston and Peter Huber, Part 1. Recorded in 2004, Walter B. Wriston, former chairman and CEO of Citicorp Citibank, and Peter Huber, senior fellow, Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, discuss the impact of information on various aspects of society and how technological advancements have transformed various industries and societies over time. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Let's start in 1945. Where were you in 1945?
I was a lieutenant in the Army in the island of Cebu, and we had a signal center there, and I was charged with two SIG ABBA machines, which were two cipher machines which were never broken, either by the Germans or the Japanese or by Americans, although they tried. And one of the happiest days of my life was when some new second lieutenant showed up and he signed for those machines. They took it rather seriously. If you lost one, they talked about court martials and things like that. So that was my original introduction, I guess, to the world of ciphers.
And encrypted telecom.
Right, encrypted telecom.
And the next 40 years were more of the same, right?
Well, the next time I ran into encryption was sort of interesting that we had a guy who came in and started all of the business on ATMs and so forth. And he said to me one day, "What are you worried about?" And I said, "I'm worried about a guy with a pair of alligator clips who's going to take $1 billion off of our computer and put it in a Swiss bank account." And he said, "Well, you'd encryption." And I said, "Yeah, right." And so some months later, I get a call from the Department of Defense. And the guy said, "Do you know a man named Jack Scantlin?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, he's just filed an encryption system that's better than anything the DOD has, and there's no way we're going to issue a patent, and there's no way you're ever going to use it." And so I called him up and said, "Jack, well, what did you do?" He said, "Oh, it's just a question of mathematics. I never did know what the system was about. But now encryption is a very common thing in the internet, in banking, everywhere else. But Scanlon designed it, and I have no idea whether the government has ever used it."
But in any event, that was on your watch that that Citicorp had to, implement networks with the crypto of this power or something very comparable. You wouldn't be moving billions you moved without those.
Yeah, it wasn't as good as SIG ABBA, but it's
you sure?
It's a pretty good security, as they say.
It would have to be pretty robust.
But, hackers get in anyway. I don't know, the last number I saw was that hackers violated the Department of Defense thing some like 300,000 times a year. And they claim that they never get beyond the first ring. But I don't know whether that's true.
No, I saw you once raised the question. I'd be interested if you ever got an answer, if your views have evolved of whether the security of our communication systems for moving around money and moved around a great deal, and you pioneered so much of that, but whether the protection of those systems wasn't of comparable importance to the protection of communications with our defense systems.
We have much in common, and right now with the tracing of money with the terrorists, the openness of those systems or the ability to access them becomes more and more important to the government, which is looking to see where Al-Qaeda is funded.
Some words you spoke or wrote are inscribed, where is it, on the wall of one of the New York libraries, right?
That's right. So they are.
The words, or shall I remind you of them?
Yeah, I know the word.
Information about money has become almost as important as money itself.
Right.
It's still almost.
As I say, but mine enemy had written a book. Yes, I think it's still true that the information about money is almost as important as money. And we see it every day in everything from a 10K to your bank statement to your ability to access an online banking system has information about money. So I have no reason to withdraw that statement. Do you agree with that?
The only qualification, I wonder, is whether you're almost was right. I don't know that if we haven't reached the point, particularly in New York, where the information about money is worth more than the underlying. Well, I mean, that's almost impossible, it would seem. But
yeah, well, every once in a while, it's true. Even on the subway now, you access it with a card. They no longer take money or tokens. So that, in effect, I suppose it's stored money, but it's information about stored
money. Well, if I extract my exhibit here, this is so commonplace now, and I think very few people fully grasp that this is the world you created. But if I'm in Venice frankly, if I'm in Oshkosh and I want to rent a car, I can't do it with Alan Greenspan's money, but I can with yours.
You can, right, yeah. Right, it's right. Amazing.
Or I can't check into a hotel with Greenspan's currency is not as good. This is your money, right?
Well,
this is my Citibank sort of. I don't even know what to call it anymore because. I used to have thought this is a credit card, but of course it's a debit card, and it's my identification system, and it's a promise of future performance.
There are still a lot of places where a folded $10 bill to the concierge will still get you a cab.
Yeah, but it won't buy me the cab.
It won't buy you the cab, but the credit card will. But I don't think cash is ever going to go out of style, but it's... It becomes less and less of a factor, let's put it that way.
For the big transactions, it's virtually illegal.
Oh, it's gone for big transactions.
It's even illegal.
Well, you can't take, as I remember, more than $5,000 out of the country unless you report it.
In cash. Whereas I can carry my credit cards with impunity, right?
The old days, the weapon of choice to smuggle money across borders was to buy a very expensive stamp that cost maybe $30,000 and glue it with a very thin thing on an envelope and put the envelope in your pocket. And that was the best way to avoid the old days of foreign exchange control.
Then resell it to another stamp dealer on the other side.
Sure. Right?
The Swiss stamps. And
sure.
Right? Bring your valuables.
So that was the weapon of choice for smugglers for a while. But the foreign exchange controls are now basically all gone. There's a few countries left, but not many.
I don't know if how many people grasp or and if you even will be willing to fess up to what a crucial, central role you personally played in creating so many of these instruments.
Well, I don't think I played so much of a role in it. We had an extraordinary group of people in the Citibank, and we worked on a very simple basis. We didn't care what color you were or the color of your passport or whether you were a man or woman. All we cared was, could you do the job? And the result was that... I got some flowers for a lot of things I didn't do, and I got some brickbats with some things I did or didn't do. But the ideas kept bubbling up from this extraordinary group of people who are now our alumni, and they're running maybe 20 central banks of the world, and Wells Fargo Bank and the Continental Illinois. And the vice chairman of bankers and so forth. And they were the people that generated these ideas. And I sold some of them, or tried to. But it came from so many sources that to say I did it, I happened to be in a job at the time.
I happened to be CEO, and all these very bright people did all these things.
Yeah, they were. I tried to recruit them because I'm a great believer in IQ, let alone to generate ideas.
But I mean, fine. It happened on your watch. Automatic teller machine, which without which we could scarcely live today. I mean, yours was the first. Huh?
Yeah. One of the funny things is that up until last year, the statistics of the U.S. government put banking at zero productivity.
So no productivity improvements.
And none. And these are the guys that went in and got their cash every Friday night with the machine. And I'm pleased to say that they now have some productivity ascribed to banks.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, conventional productivity you see in the statistics, there it somehow the improvements pass through two or three middlemen. The main gift you gave me and you know, 200 million other Americans in with your, what you called, I think your, it was going to be your, what was it? You didn't call it the thin client. It was the thin branch, right? You were inventing a thin branch, the thin bank branch, decades before people talked about thin clients.
Wow.
And that was, in fact, was your philosophy, a big part
right.
of your philosophy, your moving philosophy.
You're trying to use the cart as a delivery system.
Yeah. And what it gave me and all of us was time, right? You just gave it directly to us instead of lining up or hiking to a, and that won't show up in Alan Greenspan's statistics, will it? Well, I get me just tired.
Well, it does now a little bit, but the fact is we don't know how to measure productivity of intellectual capital. Productivity is an artifact of the industrial age, labor, material in, widgets out. Now, what is the productivity of a loan officer? If he makes one loan for $1 million and it's good and repaid, is he more or less productive than the guy that makes two loans for $1 million, one of which is a bad, which don't know. I don't know how to measure the productivity of a loan officer. You can measure the productivity, the number of checks that go through the machine. You can measure the productivity of the number of hits you get on an ATM. But the intellectual capital of lending money and getting it back, so far as I know, nobody's figured out, maybe you can, how do you make that productivity?
I saw a number reading about your, I guess you were a CEO for 17 years, right? And with the bank longer than that. And at least the number I saw was under your watch or pretty close to it, you spent, what, almost $2 billion, billion, on sort of information infrastructure right. for the bank. That's about right, 1.75 or something.
I guess
and this was when a billion was still worth real money, right?
Yeah, it was. When I joined the bank, we made $17 million that year. That was before loan losses. And it's very hard to get your head around the fact that Citigroup now makes $17.8 billion.
But you actually sort of put in a couple of billion.
We put in the infrastructure, right.
In very simple terms, this has had an enormous impact on taking friction out of the movement of money, hasn't it? Of course, speeding up how fast the money moves at the same time.
I don't know. Did we talk about before how Tom Watson did this thing? I can't remember.
Not this morning. Well, go ahead.
I work for a very remarkable man named George Moore. And he had an IQ that was somewhere off the chart. And he said everything three times. And there used to be a club car that you paid, I don't know, $50, and you had a plush seat, and they hooked it on the back of the train from Greenwich. And next to George was Tom Watson. And George was a very persistent fellow. And he'd say to Tom Watson, "You ought to come down. I'm sure that IBM has a role in banking." And Tom Watson kept saying, no, it doesn't have any role in banking. And George was so annoying. After about a month, Watson gave up and said, "All right, I'll send a crowd down there." And so they came in and they said, "Paul, So this is made to order for IBM. This is bookkeeping. And that's how IBM got in the banks, kicking and screaming. And so we had these long tab runs. Remember the punch cards and all of that? And so after a while, we realized that what people wanted to know was one thing: how much money have I got in the bank? And if you called up and said, hey, Walt, how much do I have in the bank? I couldn't tell you. I'd say, well, tonight we'll make a tab run. Tomorrow morning we can find out how much money you had in the bank yesterday. And so we called up IBM and we said, we want to know what is now known as random access. And they said, that's ridiculous. Nobody wants to know that. So we went to International Telephone, Hal Janine, who had a system in Belgian post office, which incidentally never worked. And we spent a lot of money and got zero, except we got IBM's attention. And IBM then figured out a way to get random access. But what was interesting to me, a company of that skill, supposedly consumer-oriented, had to get dragged kicking and screaming into this situation.
Real-time access.
Instantaneous.
Yeah. The computers were arriving on your watch already, and then you superimposed the wires, didn't you?
Yeah, George Moorwood did that. But
added the network, didn't you? You put the network on top.
Yeah, we put a network on top of it, yeah. No, Jack Scanlon did, to be exact.
He was
remarkable.
On your watch. And your successor was, John Reed was another of your proteges, right, who had been very instrumental in this, right?
The whole of information technology, and which has permeated the whole society, people think it's just a clerk type is going to a word processor. It isn't that. It is that, but it's so much more.
And would it be accurate to say that with that infrastructure in place and not before, we then got a whole slew of new financial instruments that just didn't exist before? It's almost the network bred the new paper. I mean, certificates of deposit. These are essentially your child as well, right? And the adjustable mortgage rates. And I mean, I should think most of the mutual fund industry is essentially reliant on the same or an identical clone infrastructure.
It's interesting, and you've made the point that the mutual fund industry is in trouble because their technology is yesterday's newspaper.
Yeah, it is. I was just thinking that. They have yet to catch up with
you. Yeah, and you made the point in one of your articles that if they had real-time pricing, there wouldn't be any trading after hours. That was taking advantage of gaps in the system.
You know, Walter, I wrote that piece thinking exactly of you because, as it happened, I was researching this conversation at the same time as I was writing that. And the currency markets now are 24-hour and they're real-time, and you get a quote on a currency rate any moment of the day. It's only a matter of years before the stock paper lands the same place, right?
And sure. It's amazing that it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
But the currency markets now, the idea of arbitraging between London and Japan, it's almost gone.
In 1971, you were already CEO, right? I forget what it was called then, Citicorp, I guess, still. But you were already CEO. And that was, of course, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, when President Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, right?
That's right.
And you were there to replace it, right? You and your bank and your associates, but under your leadership, replaced the gold standard.
I argued that the gold standard was replaced by a much more rigid standard, which was the information standard. And George Shultz, Secretary of the Treasury, picked that up. And he gave a good many speeches talking about the information standard, but it's never caught on. in the lexicon of the system. But the facts are that, you know, when people talk about let's support the dollar or let's manipulate, it's a $1 trillion market in New York, and there's not enough money in the world to influence it. But what it is traders sitting in front of a Bloomberg or Reuters or whatever, not figuring out so much what the event is, but trying to figure out what the other guy's reaction to that event would be. And so the great traders figure out what the other guy's going to do and capitalize on it, which is has not been possible up until the communications got so great.
Yeah, I've read that you had said, and you know, for many marvelous turns of phrase, but the value of the dollar is now set by global plebiscite.
That's exactly right. And there are thousands of traders out there, and they make a judgment about our political system, our financial system, the action of the Congress on the budget and the deficit, and they make it on a relative basis opposite the euro now or the Japanese yen or whatever. And the system is so huge that the idea of manipulating it has gone. It's your point that if you have real-time information, it takes away a lot of the opportunities to fudge the system.
This is an extraordinary change, isn't it, in how we sort of track value. I mean, in your lifetime, and in very large measure because of the technology you pioneered, I mean, we used to, the value of our dollar used to be bullion in Fort Knox, right?
That's right.
And it's now somewhere in your network, isn't it? And it's progeny.
But it's somewhere in a global network, right.
But the one you pushed, you were ahead by a decade of everybody else.
Well, we did have some luck on that. And the other thing that happened was the enormous pool of floating capital that they now call the Eurodollar market. And when that came in, it changed a very great deal of things in the international scene.
Yeah, I've read that part of the origin of that market was Soviets holding dollars. I think you made this point, right? And they were scared of having them all actually dependent on the states. And
that's exactly right. They thought that Bobby Kennedy was going to freeze their money, and so they went to the Italian banks, and the Italian banks had a cartel, and they would pay you X amount of interest on lira. And the Russians said to him, but we'll give you a dollar deposit and we want a better rate. And that's how it started. The Russians really did invent that. And it moved from the Italy eventually over to the UK. And when the UK put in exchange controls on the British pound, they were so smart, they left the euro dollar without controls. And that demonstrated to the world that you could trust the British market. And that was a brilliant decision. And the euro dollar market, which started very small, is now the largest floating pool of capital in the world. It's amazing.
So the Russians were fleeing Bobby Kennedy, and of course in the U.S., your typical checking account, at least for a long time, couldn't pay any interest, right?
That's right.
But you could get interest in Europe, and
exactly.
People like you then set up the networks that let you do that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, we had an anti-consumer thing called Regulation Q. And it was terrible because they said to you as a consumer, you don't get a market rate for your money. You get price controls, and it took us 20 years, I guess, to get rid of that thing. And the argument of the Fed at that time was, well, you banks are so dumb that you will pay outrageous amounts of interest to attract deposits. And this is what happened in 1929 when the call rate was 18%, and this will happen again and you'll all go broke. And I argued that the market wouldn't permit that, and it turned out it didn't. But when you think of price controls on money, we had them for a long time. One of our problems was to get rid of it.
But for, I don't know what the number is now, 100 million American households with deposit accounts now earning whatever they're earning, 1 or 2 or 3% of current rates, but for what you did so much to pioneer and break through, I mean, the networks, they would still, that was zero before, right?
Yeah, it was zero before. Yeah, you couldn't pay interest on demand deposits. And the CD came about because the demand deposits of the city of New York, where we operated, didn't increase for a decade.
It's done.
There was a marginal increase, but I mean basically. So that you didn't have to be too smart to know that you were going to be out of business very shortly because you didn't have any inventory. You couldn't get any money. So we sat around and said, well, how can we get money? And so the idea was to issue a CD, a certificate of deposit. Up until then, there were some outstanding which were used for margin requirements in commodity markets. So the argument was, are you issuing money? And if you have a CD that's due on demand, that argument can be made. And so we had a big debate about, do we go to the Fed on this? And the answer was, no, we don't. But we went over to the Discount Corporation, and we said, will you make a market in CDs? And they said, well, we'll make a market if you give us a line of credit of $10 million, which in those days, a lot of money. And we said, well, we never loan Discount Corporations clean. And they said, well, that's the price of making a market. And so we went back, and George Moore and a bunch of us got together. We made the loan, and we issued the first CD, which was greeted poorly by our friends on the street. The other banks called up and said, what are you, nuts? You're going to pay money on deposits that you don't have to. And we said, yeah, but we can't get deposits unless we pay interest on them. And that market took off like amazing. Until today, it's a major factor in the financing of the world, I think.
And once again, it wouldn't have been possible but for your instant real-time pricing of the underlying assets, right? You couldn't have been able to quote people.
And also that the horse was out of the barn before the regulators could say that it wasn't okay. And very hard for them. They were very disturbed about it. But, you know, by the time they got through their study, there was $1 billion of the stuff floating around out there. So that, but it was a bypass of Regulation Q. There's no question about it.
You enlisted the technology and just made it happen.
Sure.
What is hot money, and how much are you to blame for the heat, the temperature of money today?
Well, the hot money is money that seeks the highest return, often for the shortest period of time. And obviously the international network permits people to move money all over the world looking for that incremental thing. And how much is out there, I don't have a clue. Probably not as much as the headliners think, and probably a lot less than you think, because most of the money moving in it is in for real. But there's enough to influence rates in many countries. I don't think there's any doubt.
And if we took the average temperature of money, I mean, to use the expression, I mean, if when you entered banking, the money was pretty darn cold still.
It was cold. It's hotter now.
It's a lot hotter, right? Yeah. I mean, you're not, and I'm whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, this ability to move the money very fast has.
The ability to do it will be taken advantage of by good guys and bad guys. And the bad guys in Al-Qaeda are clearly moving money all around, laundering it, trying to get, they take advantage of the network just they take advantage of the internet. So that, you know, every miracle drug has a side effect. And one of the side effects of the network is that bad guys can use it the way good guys can.
So, Bonnie and Clyde used cars too, right?
Yeah,
that happens with, I'm a technology optimist like you. I think overwhelmingly the good uses overcome the bad. But I mean, you've made the point, again, you phrase it much more beautifully than I can, that money goes
where it's wanted and stays where it's well treated. That's all she wrote.
And of course, the obstacle historically, I mean, before your watch, was money wanted to go where she was well treated, right? But it was tough to get it there, right? And it took time, and there was friction in the system. You took a lot of that away, didn't you?
And we had all of these exchange controls. And don't ever forget that, you know, after the war, just about everybody had exchange controls so that the money couldn't move or very little could move. You could take it out in a tin box, but that was about it. So now their exchange controls are an artifact of the past, I hope.
So we see, or it seems we see these days, quite a bit of volatility. Now, are we imagining that? Are things, by taking all this friction out of the system, has it become more unstable, or is it more stable?
Well, I don't know whether it's more stable or less stable, but the volatility is certainly there. 1972, I think it was, or three, the New York Stock Exchange broke down on 14 million shares a day. And we had to close it on Wednesday. And obviously, I won't go into how it was fixed, but today the talking heads on television say, well, it was a modest day on the street. It was 1 billion shares. And that was totally made possible by basically tandem computers, nonstop systems in the back of the thing. So that created volatility unlike anything we've ever seen before.
I'm wondering, and I'd be interested in your views, that volatility is a very interesting and difficult thing to measure. You can take any one indicator and plot it out, and you can say, wow, this thing is swinging a lot more than it used to in the old days. On the other hand, from the consumer's perspective, with the instruments that, with the tools you put in place, it's my impression, I'd be very interested in your views, is in fact it is very possible with your infrastructure that you were built to take volatility out of your own life. I mean, I can diversify now across currency markets and across equity markets and across debt and equity. So in my own existence, I mean, you can flatten it out as much as you like, can't you?
That's true, but the ability to do that creates volatility in and of itself, I suppose.
Does it? Does it for the individual person? I mean, if a person wants stable portfolio.
If there were 50,000 Ubers out there, which there aren't, and they all are trying to diversify their portfolio at the same time and take advantage of the euro or the yen or whatever, wouldn't that create volatility?
I don't know. I'm asking you, Walter, because, you know, the question is the sum, I mean, after all, Wall Street is insanely volatile at the individual level, right?
Right.
In the aggregate, it's...
In the aggregate, it's not. I agree.
Yeah, and the sort of sum, I mean, markets themselves are this aggregation of idiosyncratic and emotional and often irrational choices. But you were just making the point, you know, the under your new information standard, the Riston standard of value now, you have two people in London and Frankfurt who both think they know where the dollar ought to go, but they may think the opposite, right?
Exactly.
And together.
That's what makes ball games, right?
And more stable, less? I don't know. I suppose we have to wait 50 years to find out.
Well, I don't know. Everything is relative in the world. And you know, in the 40s, late 40s and 50s, where the total foreign exchange market in New York City was $50 million a day. So that if the Fed wanted to stabilize the dollar, they call up the Morgans or the city and say, hey, go and buy $10 million. Well, $10 million on a $50 million market does something. So the volatility wasn't much, and there were only, I would say, six foreign exchange traders in New York. Okay, today with a $1 trillion market, if the Fed calls up and says go buy $10 million, I mean, it wouldn't even be noticed. That's the point, that the market, to a certain extent, is out of control. Looks like Kevin Kelly's book, Out of Control, that it's so big and so many players that nobody can influence it except momentarily. So the answer to that, I think, is good in the sense that the only way you can influence it is to put in policies which are regarded by the world as sensible.
As friendly to me.
And it's, I guess, George Shultz's book, Economic Policy Beyond the Headlines, sort of lays out his concept of what those policies are. But to say, hey, the dollar is going down today, do something about it. The only way you can do something about it is to have monetary and fiscal policies that a lot of people around the world think are useful. And I don't see any other way to do it. And so to a large extent, the administration, whatever it is, has lost control.
Now,
does that make sense?
Yes, very much so. On your watch, of course, and since your watch, and no doubt before your watch too, I mean, we've seen certainly a number of currencies, not the dollar, although it's gone through its swings, but I mean, in some countries that are arguably not well run, they've seen tremendous volatility in their currencies.
Yeah.
And
and you still do have some.
Yes, I mean, Argentina, Mexico, I think, on your watch, and
Asia, Thailand.
What is this information? I mean, this is all the information that has emerged from your infrastructure. What is it? Is it telling us true things, good things, necessary things about these countries?
Well, I think it tells us true things, and it tells you a lot of things you don't want to know. It's like getting a CAT scan, which is a new technology, basically. And you walk in there and you're feeling pretty good and you get a CAT scan and the guy comes around and said, hey, you got a bunch of tumors growing in you that you didn't know about. Okay. That's a bad thing from the patient's point of view, but it's a good thing if they can do something about it. And I think the same thing is true in a currency. And if Malaysia's currency is going in the toilet because it's because the international community looks at their economic and monetary policies and says they're bad. Okay, so the initial response is to say they're a bunch of cowboys who are attacking my currency and they all ought to be shot. And after a while, cooler heads prevail and say, well, maybe we had something to do with our own demise. And Therefore, you get a reaction to put in better policies in order to save the currency. And one of the problems has been that they say that the London School of Economics ruined more countries' economies in Africa than anybody in history. But I would argue that the International Monetary Fund is a close second. And they go into these countries and say the thing you do is you raise taxes and you try to get a balance of payments equilibrium and you have a tight fiscal policy. All the things that will stop growth. And the only thing that will get out of these messes is to have growth. And so argument can be made that when the fund goes in there, they put in the wrong policies which exacerbate the issue. But that's a question that's going to be debated forever. I have one view on it, and other people have other views on it.
Almost a century and a half ago, a fellow who knew no economics at all but had an enormous impact, Karl Marx, postulated this tremendous sort of antagonism, if you will, between capital, money, Walter Wriston, in other words, and labor. The poor stiff out there who's actually in the factory or knitting the clothes or what have you. Now, Marx was wrong on most everything, but we see echoes of this now around with the money able to move so freely, which is very much a consequence of what you put into effect. Does the disposable worker go with the stateless money? Is that a consequence of, is it a good thing?
We have to bear in mind the United States of America is a very remarkable place in many ways, but one of it is that we don't have a cash system. The idea that a kid from Wisconsin like me or my partner Billy Spencer from Colorado could come into a big financial institution and be promoted doesn't happen in other countries. They come in from high social standing. So that we have a track for people who want to work and who are bright to get ahead in society. A lot of societies don't have that. And part of that is the idea of universal education, which unfortunately is not as good as it used to be for K through 12, as we're finding out. But we still have the greatest universities in the world. And one of the things that's puzzled me all my life, if the K through 12 is so bad, how come the universities are so good? Because they're using the inventory from the schools. And I think the answer to that is the GI Bill of Rights. When we came out of the Army, one of the greatest things in the history of the country was that we had a voucher and we could go to any university we wanted and get an education, and millions of us did. And nobody said, hey, if you go to Notre Dame, it's a violation of church and state, or if you go to Oral Roberts, or if you go to Yeshiva, or wherever you go. Nobody raised that issue. That's always fascinated me, because it was the first voucher system. And what it did was cause all the universities to pull up their socks and compete for us. And competition is what makes the mayor run. And I believe the current situation that Milton has been working on and everybody else, to get vouchers in the lower schools to get some competition, is the only answer to that. But it's the ability of the country to take disparate groups from all over and give them an education, or expose them to an education, let's put it that way, And there isn't any limit to how far they can go. And that's a very remarkable thing in the world. And I would say that that's the most driver in our economy, because you see, for example, in Germany, if a automobile company wants to put a plant in another town, the people in one town will not move to the other town. There's no mobility of labor. In this country, I don't know how many places you've lived in the United States, but I would guess more than one.
Yes, I
would. And as I have, and it's very hard to find somebody who has lived in the same house for 100 years.
But with the mobility of capital that Citicorp and you created, is it not now inevitable? And this is, of course, a global mobility. It's not just Missouri to New York. It's worldwide. An almost inevitable consequence of that is a mobility, as you yourself have always anticipated, of factories and of direct investment, and therefore of jobs as well. And if I understand the answer you were just developing, I mean, there is no antidote to that other than to compete, right, and domestically.
That's right. It is when we have this flop now, you know, about outsourcing jobs, and it's the oldest economic thing in the world. And you go where the cost of production is the lowest. And a lot of people confuse labor rates with labor productivity. And there's a big difference. And people come to this country because our productivity is so high. And that's the point I was trying to make in this piece today, that it's so difficult for the European countries with no mobility of labor and a very high social cost to compete in a world market. So they outsource to us. And they build the factories and we staff them. But forever, labor has moved around where the marginal cost of labor is the lowest. For example, there were 1900, there were 20 million people on American farms. Today there's 1.5 million, and we feed the world. And how does that happen? It happened with the greatest transfer of technology in history, which was the land grant college. And the land grant colleges were sent out there, and they told them about crop rotation, and they told them about fertilization, and they told them about all of these things. And the productivity on American farms is mind-boggling.
Oh, I think. Or to bring it closer to home, I mean, we're sitting here in New York. You put in place on your watch over 20 years at Citicorp the technology that by some logic ought to have killed the city. I mean, the city is extremely expensive. It's very crowded. It's very difficult to live in. And with your networks, nobody has to live in this city at all. They can do their banking from anywhere in the world. And yet New York has risen on this. It hasn't fallen at all, right?
Well, that's true. The flip side of that is that I don't think any great idea ever came out of anything but an urban environment. From, you know, Aristotle and Plato all the way through. And while it is true the internet and other things create groups and conversations and bulletin boards, there's nothing like going to the lunch of the Manhattan Institute and listening to Peter Hubert tell us about the way that the spectrum is wasted by the regulators in Washington or whatever the topic is. Because in New York, you meet people smarter than you are every day, and if you're not careful, you learn something. And it has a dynamic that I don't think technology will ever change. It's like a college campus.
I agree. I mean, it's so interesting that the real test of this thesis that the mobility of money and the networks and so on are antithetical to U.S. interests, at least where you implemented them first and most directly and most aggressively, they seem to have had the opposite effect. I mean, New York has not sort of become one among 50 places that do banking and trade stocks and currencies. It has become all the more powerful and preeminent on the strength of this technology. In fact, the technology that could have decentralized New York finance that you implemented has, by some magic, had the opposite effect.
Well, I think part of it is the ability of meeting people face to face. You can get a college degree now on the internet. There are colleges, as you know, out there that you just internet. But most of them also have an arrangement with, say, Columbia or NYU or somebody where you have some guru you can go and talk to. And so that with all of the technology and all of the anti-gravity forces like the universe that spreads out, you also have the human factor, I think, that meeting people socially, listening to what they have to say, gossiping about this, that, and the other thing is still a very important, extremely important part of the way the world works.
I want to perhaps wrap up by lining up your tenure at Citicorp. I don't know if you'd ever checked the dates, but you know, it you joined just about when George Orwell was writing in 1984. What, late 40s was it?
That's when George Orwell was 1984. Then.
No, he wrote it in 48. When did you join the bank?
I joined 46.
Yeah, so George was out there writing this future, and of course you retired from the bank in 84 itself. Now, as we both know in that book, I mean, Orwell and your rough contemporary was predicting by 1984 this world run by, it was nominally Big Brother, but Big Brother was a fiction. It was actually this group of powerful oligarchs, the bankers, the bureaucrats, the Walter Wristons, in other words. It was your types, exactly, right, who would have this network extending out globally, by the way. Orwell saw all of that, and it would be this terrible tyranny, the worst tyranny the world had ever seen, and you would control everything. Is that about how it played out, Walter?
It turned out just the reverse. CNN killed it.
Well, or Walter Wristen did.
He was 100% wrong, and your book, Orwell's Revenge, puts out that the technology, rather than creating tyranny, created openness. And today, it's extraordinary on the real-time information you get about everything. And I think the biggest problem now is probably overload. How do you get so much data out there that it's sorting it out? We have the example right now. We have this commission looking at 9/11. Well, in every major crisis, there is somewhere some guy has written a memorandum that predicted it. I remember on Pearl Harbor, I served in the State Department with a guy who sat in a back room somewhere, and I said, what do you do? Well, he said, I was a Foreign Service officer in Japan, and I kept writing these cables saying Japan is going to attack the United States. And they said, well, you're in some kind of a nut. Why don't you go away? And so it's true in a corporation. If there's a scandal in a corporation, I will guarantee you that there's a memo in a file written by somebody who said, I predicted that, and they didn't listen to me. And the point is that there's a million points of data out there, and you can prove anything. The question is human judgment on which of those data points means something.
And your judgment, which you translated into action, is now in all our wallets, and it shapes our financial life.
It wasn't mine, but it was a lot of people's.
It was, Walter.